The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, new research gives us a more accurate picture of the lifespan of whales, and some whales may live longer than previously thought. And scientists using a massive telescope in British Columbia have located a mysterious, repeating source of radio waves from far across space. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Whales are believed to have long lifespans, but a new study aims to give a more accurate assessment on the age of certain species. Due to the legacy of industrial whaling, populations of many species were decimated, making it difficult to study their lifespans accurately. But new research on Balaenidae, baleen whales, including bowhead whales and endangered right whales, helps form a more complete picture. The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with Dr. Greg Breed, an associate professor of quantitative ecology at the University of Alaska, to learn more.
Well, there's four species within the Balaenidae, which are the right and bowhead whale. So there's the southern right whale, the North Atlantic right whale, the North Pacific right whale, and the bowhead whale. Bowhead's actually the whale that I kind of inspired me to do this because of a colleague of mine who discovered that they lived to be over 200. And that sort of got into this interest in understanding how long whales live.
So how do you discover the age of this whale? What methods do you use to collect the data and then therefore make an age estimation?
So it's tricky. The reason it's tricky is that most whales require a lethal sample to age them. And that means that the most recent period we had a large sample of that was the 1960s and 70s during the end of industrial whaling. So the classic ways that they're done are, in terms of like direct aging, are to count laminations, like layers in the earplug. So the earwax builds up through their whole life and actually causes layers like you have on your teeth or tree rings. The other way we traditionally do it, and this is how it's been done in a lot of the indigenous Arctic hunts, particularly the bowhead hunt at Ukliavik, otherwise known as Barrow, is to look at changes in the proteins of the eyelands. So the proteins in your eyelands, they don't turn over like a lot of other parts of your body, don't get regenerated. So those proteins, they're there when you're born, or at least when you're very young. And then they gradually change to a different configuration through time. And we can look at the ratios of two different configurations of aspartic acid and estimate how old animals are. Now, we couldn't do that with the right whales that we analyze because we don't want to lethal sample them for a wide variety of ethical reasons. It's not a question worth killing whales for. So we looked at marked recapture data, which is just to say people have been taking photographs of whales of these two species, southern right whales off of South Africa and North Atlantic right whales off the east coast of US and Canada since the 70s, essentially, and matching up patterns of barnacles and scars to identify individuals and follow them their whole lives. And then we look at how individuals from those data sets disappear through time, and we can estimate a survivorship curve. And this is the same thing the Social Security Administration does today to know how much it's going to owe seniors 50 years from now, so they can look at how the shape of the survivorship curve of current living individuals is shaping up and estimate how long they expect those cohorts to live 30, 40 years from now. We essentially did that. We did a little bit of a modification because whales are hard to spot. You have this thing called detection probability where you simply go out, and some years you won't see some individuals because you don't have perfect observation. And then there's also an issue of individuals living past the end of the observation period. That's called censoring, as well as unknown birthdays, which is left truncation. And those are two statistical issues that we had to include in our models in order to make these estimates without doing the more traditional lethal sampling, which is a much more difficult task.
So, just how old or long can these whales live? Like, what's their average lifespan or
Well,
longevity?
there's the average lifespan that we're seeing. So this is the average lifespan that we estimated was very different for southern right whales compared to North Atlantic right whales. So the average age of southern right whales, their average age of death is 74, we found. And that doesn't sound that different from people, but keep in mind that they have a survivorship curve that looks more like humans in the 1300s, because they don't have modern medicine or public health, so they have diseases and they starve to death too. They don't have the same steady resources humans do. So although humans live about the same time on average, very shortly after our average, we start to die at extremely high rates, and they don't. So we have a much longer tail, many more individuals surviving past 100 than we do for humans. Something like 30, 25 to 30% live past 100, we estimate, for the southern right whales, and about 10% live past 130, with some smaller amount living even longer. But we don't really know that tail very well.
At what ages do they, have a family and then they reproduce and then they go out? If they take it fast or slower, does that like increase their longevity in any way?
Yeah, there's a whole body of work. There's a whole hypothesis. There's an idea known as the pace of life syndrome, which is animals can choose to have life histories, which are just the general term for how animals structure their reproductive lives, to go fast, which is mean you grow quickly, you begin reproducing very quickly. You might have a larger number of offspring in any given reproductive attempt. You have shorter periods between reproductive attempts. And then you tend to die young because that's really hard on you to put all that expenditures. A slower pace of life is more like humans, which they don't become sexually mature until they're 15, and they don't typically reproduce until they're 25. But when that's kind of like bowhead whales, right? They don't become sexually mature until they're about 15 or 20, and they don't begin reproducing until they're 25 or 30 regularly, and then they have calves every 3 years at most, and maybe once every 4 or 5 years, and so they have a much, and then they invest heavily in each individual that they reproduce, so it's a much larger investment in each individual offspring, many fewer offspring per over the course of time. So you have longer periods between offspring, more investment when you have them, and that produces individuals that are just more. So that's a strategy that evolves when there's a huge amount of intraspecific competition in the environment. That's competition from other individuals of your own species for resources, because if you produce calves that are really, they're not precocious, they can't really make it on their own very well, and let them become independent, where others of your species are investing heavily. Those your peers who are letting their offspring become independent at a much older age, that are more capable, they're going to do better than you because your calves are going to die. So that longer investment causes you to sort of have a longer strategy. Along that, the downside of that is that strategy requires you to live a long time, and if ecological factors are killing you before you can make those investments, it's not going to be work very well, which is kind of what we think is going on with the North Atlantic right whale right now. So they have a life history strategy that is similar to southern right whales. They're living much shorter lifespans, and that's causing the population to be so critically endangered, and really not recovering after whaling the same way southern right whales are.
And then finally, what do you hope to learn or excited about in the future of this research or whatever you're researching right now?
Well, the big thing that so we have another paper in the works on just looking at the effects of whaling on the current demographic makeup, and well, when we expect old individuals to reappear, which turns out to be a really long time. That's our analyses right now suggest it's still going to be another 50 or 100 years before the pre-whaling demographic makeup returns, and that presupposes that we're not going to have some terrible or big change in the world that global warming might cause. But the other thing that I'm really interested in about is the role of teeth in all this, and the evolution of baleen. Because the other thing that baleen did for whales that other mammals don't enjoy is that baleen doesn't wear out. It just continually grows. It's made out of the same material as your fingernails, and it just wears it off when it gets too long, and they can just use it. Where teeth, they wear out. And when animals run out of teeth, they can't eat anymore and they get all these pathologies. So we think that teeth, the evolution of baleen might be a really critical invention for whales that was really important for longevity, because if having teeth that wear out before the rest of your body wears out, it's just the same as another senescent process, getting cancer. And we don't really have or other degenerative diseases. If you're human, you go to the dentist and have it fixed. But if you're an animal, your teeth fall out. That's just as bad for your survival as getting cancer or having, some other cellular disease that causes you to not function. But mammals don't really have a lot of variation, especially large mammals, in their dentition. So we know that ungulates, which are actually the most closely related branch to whales, particularly the even-toed ungulates, which are like your deer and your moose and cows, actually. We know that wild ungulates, when their teeth wear out, they die. That's basically it. So if you're but they're cousins in the sea, they don't have teeth to wear out, and so they just keep growing baleen, and it's just continually refreshed. And then that allows them to filter feed and has all these other advantages that give them the potential to live a long lifespan. So that's the really exciting thing that I don't know how I'm going to answer it, but I think that the evolution of baleen and the negative impacts of teeth on our ability to live a long time, or animals' ability, but people too, or animals, is a direction I'm really excited to sort of to look into next. And I don't know where it goes, but it seems like there's a lot of potential.
Dr. Greg Breed is an associate professor of quantitative ecology at the University at Alaska. His latest research into whale longevity is published in the journal Science. Dr. Breed spoke with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Earth is constantly bombarded with electromagnetic waves. And for nearly two decades, intense bursts of radio waves from deep space have puzzled scientists. Fast radio bursts, or FRBs, were first detected in 2007. But the source of such radiation remains a mystery. Our next guest is Calvin Leung, a Miller Postdoctoral Fellowship recipient at the University of California, Berkeley. According to Calvin, one FRB hits the Earth every 2 minutes. To listen for these bursts, Leung partnered with scientists at the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment. The CHIM telescope in British Columbia has been searching for the source of FRBs. Calvin largely wrote the computer code that allowed his team to pinpoint the source of waves near the star constellation Ursa Minor. The discovery also changes what scientists thought they knew about FRBs. The bursts weren't coming from the center of a distant galaxy. They were seemingly coming from a place far from it. Calvin Leung's research is published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. I spoke with him to learn more.
My research is in the field of fast radio burst science. And as the name implies, these fast radio bursts are these flashes of radio light coming from beyond our galaxy. Since the field is so young, we don't exactly know what produces these signals, although we now know that they're extraterrestrial in origin and they come from beyond our galaxy. So that's not tens or hundreds or thousands of light years away, but instead millions or billions. And so one major question in the field now is what kinds of strange stellar objects in the universe a billion light years away can produce these radio flashes that are so powerful that you can see them a billion light years away, and yet so brief that they last only about a millisecond.
Sure, they sound like chirping birds almost when converted into audio.
Absolutely. And that's one of the most fascinating aspects of these signals is that on their way to Earth, they experience a delay that sort of depends on exactly the frequency that you're observing at. So, in other words, the longer wavelength light experiences a longer delay than the shorter wavelength light. So, you will indeed hear sort of a chirping signal if you listen to these things as they come in.
Now, of course, we could see stars at night when we look up, so we know that light is traveling through the universe. But why was it so surprising to get these types of radio waves in particular? And how are these different than seeing stars in the sky?
Yeah, so we can actually see really far in the universe if you're really clever about it. If you observe at millimeter wavelengths, which is where your microwave heats food, then you can see basically all the way back to the Big Bang. You can see the cosmic microwave background. And that's, hundreds, tens or hundreds of billions of light years away. Now, it turns out that it's hard to put an exact number to that because it depends on how you define distance in an expanding universe. So that's the absolute farthest you can see with light. We also, as you said, we see galaxies and stars using ordinary light that you can see with our eyes. These are visible wavelengths, not a millimeter in wavelength, but maybe a micron or a millionth of a meter or less. The frequencies that we're talking about in these fast radio bursts, as their name implies, they're in radio frequencies. And these are maybe like 1 meter. And so one single wavelength of this light is the size of a human being, basically. It's much lower frequency. And that means it's actually easier to see radio waves farther out because for sources in the universe, it's less expensive to produce this low energy radio photons than it is to produce things like X-rays or gamma rays. And so in the radio, we can actually see really, really far out in the universe. Not all the way back to the Big Bang, but there are a number of groups who are trying to push radio observations all the way back.
Now, do these waves, these chirping waves, can they have any impact on any technology that's in space, satellites, or spacecraft, or anything that is communicating with Earth? Is this something that could potentially scramble communications?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think if anything is powerful enough, then it certainly can. The reason we are not really worried about these bursts is that since they're so distant, by the time they arrive at Earth, they're kind of weak. It's like seeing a tsunami all the way across the world. If you're really close, then you might be in trouble, and you should run. But if you're all the way on the other side of the world, you won't even feel like a very powerful tsunami, just because those waves get smaller as you go to larger and larger distances from the source. There are certain kinds of radio signals which we would really be worried about, and these are actually generated by our sun. So the sun will occasionally have these coronal mass ejections or these solar flares, which can potentially disrupt things like satellite and radio communications here on Earth. But those events are quite rare, and the Earth has an ionosphere which partially shields us from the most damaging effects of the sun. And again, that's because the sun is so nearby, not because it's intrinsically an extremely violent source in the universe.
Now, is there anything that from this research that would lead to any further research or any thinking about how humans can use similar kinds of radio waves to send messages even farther than maybe the technology that we currently have on hand? Is this something that comes up in your mind?
Yeah, this is a good point. We think about using radio communications to do things like find asteroids. It turns out that because of the way radio light versus visible light propagates. You can get farther with visible light because the beam of light doesn't spread as much. And this allows you to deliver more power in a directed way rather than having it spread out in many different directions. And so for the purposes of speculative efforts, like, trying to communicate with some hypothetical civilizations, people have thought about doing this in both optical and the radio. The benefit of using radio is that because your waves are sort of spreading out in many different directions, and then you could potentially discover more of these, more civilizations if you're trying to search for them. But if you want to do targeted communication, you might want to use optical wavelengths where you can deliver a lot of power into a small amount of sky at once.
Now, do you have any theories or maybe favorite guesses as to what you hope these radio waves might be coming from? Do you have any venture any guesses as to what might be producing them?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think a lot of people are embroiled in a major debate about this. So to the best of our knowledge, the favored emission channel for these bursts is an exotic type of star. These are called neutron stars. They are basically giant atoms. And what I mean by that is, whereas you would think of ordinary atoms as a couple of protons and neutrons hanging out in a nucleus with electrons going around it, neutron stars are gravitationally bound clumps of neutrons. And they're entirely made of nuclear matter. And as we know, the nucleus of an atom is extremely dense, whereas most of the atom is actually empty space where the electron is zipping around. Similarly, neutron stars are purely nuclear matter and they weigh about the mass of our sun. But you take all of that mass and you squish it into a ball that's about 10 kilometers on a side. And so that's, if you can imagine something as massive as our sun, but squeezed into a tiny amount of space, we know that these things exist from our own galaxy. And it's not a big stretch of the imagination to think that similar stars in other galaxies, millions or billions of light years away, could produce the signals that we observe on Earth. One particular discovery that led us to believe this is that our telescope called CHIME, the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, that telescope not only observed the FRB, the fast radio burst, on the outskirts of a massive elliptical galaxy, as we discussed, but it also detected a very similar looking burst from a source in our own galaxy, which we knew since the 1990s. And that source was one of these neutron stars. And so it's then not such a big stretch of the imagination to think that the extragalactic radio bursts are very come from similar origins as the one we saw in the Milky Way.
Where will your research lead you next now? Where does this point you? What direction does this point you in?
Yeah, so currently my research is in upgrading CHIME into a fully fledged array of telescopes. So previously, CHIME didn't have the resolution to pinpoint some of its discoveries. My PhD work, and now my research as a postdoc, has been leading the charge to turn CHIME into a telescope that can not only detect many of these signals, but can pinpoint them too. So we can figure out exactly where in the sky they're coming from. And that is crucial to understanding the origin of these mysterious fast radio bursts. We just achieved first light with the full array last week. And so we're looking forward to pinpointing something like one of these signals every day now, with an accuracy that's so good that you could resolve a quarter, miles away. And what that'll let you do is pinpoint what kinds of stars emit these bursts. What kind of galaxies do they come from? Do they come from galaxies which are red and dead and haven't formed new stars in many years? Or do they come from young blue galaxies that are actively forming massive stars that could potentially produce FRBs? I think the jury is still out, and we'll need a larger sample of these events in order to conclusively answer the question of where they come from.
Well, Calvin, that sounds fascinating. Best of luck in your research, and thank you so much for speaking with me. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that you think we're missing?
I guess I'll just end by saying that it's really exciting to be working in such a young field where there are so many unknowns to be answered. And when we're still having these heated debates on the on questions as basic as what causes these bursts, what are they? I think it's really liberating for young people in this field, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how radio astronomy, particularly radio transient science, which is I would call my subfield, how this field progresses over the next decade. In the future, we can imagine using these sources as a way, as measuring sticks in order to map out the universe, much in the same way that supernovas tell us the universe is expanding, or the same way that the cosmic microwave background tells us the origin of the universe. And so that's another aspect that we didn't get to talk much about, but which I think is going to be really exciting in the next decade. And it's all enabled by these exciting radio telescopes that, like Chime, that we're building.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Lucas.
Calvin Leung is a Miller Postdoctoral Fellowship recipient at the University of California, Berkeley. His research into mysterious fast radio bursts coming from space is published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. If you'd like to tell The Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1797. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.